time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold. Bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceiveth, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long.
Hi, and welcome to Sonnet 73. This is a podcast on the aging and the challenges of aging. And here we have with us
Visa Srinivasan. I'm a board certified internist and geriatrician working for Health First Aging Institute.
Jennifer Peranis. I'm a social worker working in geriatrics for the last 5 years.
Okay, and Jenny.
I'm Jenny Murdoch. I'm also a social worker in geriatrics.
And I'm David Slonim. I'm an elder law attorney, and we are starting a podcast on the very topics of aging and looking forward to covering a wide range of issues that people come into when they are in the autumn of their life. So what's going on? What's new, Dr. Visa?
Well, I see a lot of people getting really worried about the maze that they have to navigate as they age. This has to do with a lot of things like memory loss, falling, worried about medications, and many times they don't know where to turn to. Because in this day and age when they spend most of their time with different doctors, different providers, they don't have a place that they can go to where they can assimilate all of these and get a sense of direction as to what the options are. And hopefully this podcast will shed some light on the different resources and different options that are available to them.
As an elder lawyer, it's really my domain that my expertise is in dealing with the special problems that seniors have in this later in life, the caring issues, the financial matters, and not just the estate planning documents that people who are looking at this time of life, that these, you know, we're not just looking at wills and trusts, we're looking at how are you going to pay for this care, how are you going to deal with the caregiving in the home or in some other facility, for example, and the changes in the lifestyle that you have that's very different from your early life or even midlife, and we're dealing with this area of life. It's a whole different area. I tell a lot of clients when they come in to do estate planning, especially for Medicaid matters or whatnot, when we have to review these things, that we are doing the planning based on this time of life, not just how you are when you're in your 20s or 30s, but or even in your 40s or 50s. Every, I think, time of your life has a whole different feel to it, that and certain different aspects to what needs to be done. And pre-40s, you don't have to worry about certain medical visits. And then after that, then the colonoscopies come in and all the other times that you really don't want to go to the doctor for that quick visit there. So, you know, I think that as an elder lawyer, I see this as growing time in people's, I guess, in the generation, you know, the World War II generation, or the greatest generation. Yeah. You know, they're still a great generation, but they're changing. Their needs are changing. It's not going into retirement anymore. Now they're looking at, will they outlive their money? Will their loved one be not really a person anymore? You know, when that loved one goes through dementia, then that body is there, but the person that they met when they were in high school, even in some cases, mm-hmm. are just not there anymore, and they have to say goodbye to them.
I hear this all the time. That's why they call it the slow goodbye, especially dementia. But this actually brings me to a common thing that I encounter every day. When patients come to a geriatrician, I always tell them that their medical issues are very closely connected with their social issues. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, I'll have someone telling me, well, somebody in church, a church friend, told me that this worked for them. Can it work for me? This can be, you know, a medication, or it can be a plan. And that's when I have to remind them about the geriatric mantra, where if I've seen one elderly patient, I've seen one elderly person, because each person is so different. Their set of circumstances is different, their social supports are different, their medical situations are different. And so one of the things that we want to bring about and what we want to show on this podcast is that we have to take into account each person and their situation so that we can uniquely come up with a plan that is tailored to meet their needs. And that is something which is really time-consuming in a doctor office setting. And I think the kind of services or the kind of information that we want to give today is for them to know that there's no one size that fits all, and that it's good for the caregivers as well as elders to know about the different array of options that are available so that they can choose the ones that are going to meet their needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about the people with boots on the ground? I mean, you as the social workers see this probably even more than the the doctors and the lawyers. I mean, you deal with this when they call you on the phone or they come crying to you for some issue. What do you see?
I think in the social work perspective, our principles are to focus on the person and the environment. And so when you take into account someone who is aging, you're looking at a very wide picture of not only, you know, that greatest generation, but looking at kind of how, you know, their upbringing was, what their views are, and how our society is different right now. There's not the same type of support, family support. You have the sandwich generation that are now caregivers to their own children and then to their parents. Mm-hmm. And taking into that emotional concept of this aging population feels that they're not as supported as they, you know, once were in that generation where everything was kind of just so, there was a lot of community, it seemed like, in that generation. There was purpose. They had a sense of pride and dedication within the community, within each other, and that seems to have kind of elapsed. A lot of families, when they struggle financially and they need to apply for Medicaid, there's a lot of different obstacles that they have to face that don't really allow them to connect with the finances so that they can actually have the services and the supports in the home.
Obstacles like the husband being the one who did all the finances, and then the wife now has to come in and figure out what the checkbook is all about and where to find the finances, because she was never told, you know, what was happening in the house, paying the bills, and you know where the insurance is for the house,
right.
Et cetera. Is
that a lot of role reversing? You know, you have a lot of spouses that were once they were the breadwinners, and then the wives were the ones who managed everything, and now their loved one has, you know, either dementia or some kind of chronic illness, where now the husband has to take on a lot of these duties, and it's very foreign for them. It's very difficult for them to transition after 70, 80 years of age. To try and support their wife as best as they can with limited resources out, financial limited resources out in the community. And I think, you know, in terms of what the hope is through the podcast is to try and connect these families, not only to just those financial resources, but self-sufficiency, you know, in terms of developing better coping skills on how to utilize creatively the supports that you have, whether it's within family or the neighborhoods, friends, church, community. There's a lot of different ways that you can connect and not necessarily feel like your options are limited to two different funding sources.
So you're saying the support is there even though it may not look like it.
Right.
So every community, even if you have some limited financial resources or other limited resources, that if you didn't have the support, you wouldn't know that those resources were there to begin with.
Right.
So that comes in from different sources, mm-hmm. and they're kind of phantom sources. You don't really know that they're there until they're presented to you, I suppose. Is that right?
Right. And bringing it to the forefront, because a lot of the times when someone is overwhelmed or stressed, it's difficult for them to kind of find that clarity. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the times just taking a step back and reevaluating and being mindful of what your supports are, you're able to better connect and kind of go through the journey of the aging process, especially if someone has dementia.
What would you classify as your top three supports, for example?
Family support, church support, and your neighbor support. And these are all supports that are more not financially related. There's a lot of churches out there that have volunteers that, you know, whether they offer transportation resources to go to the church. You know, there might be someone who really wants to go to church every Sunday to get connected, especially at that time in their life, with their spiritual side, and they just don't have a means to get to the church. And there's a lot of volunteers that will offer to pick them up and take them. Looking at the family support, utilizing them, maximizing it as much as you can. Sometimes that's not an option, and then you kind of look out to your neighbors and friendships that you have established along the way.
I've had clients come through my office that have no family support. They, through one reason or another, either everybody's died off or have just become disconnected with their family. Then they, and you know, that's one support system that is not available to them. And I don't know about you, but I don't know my neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And so I imagine that in the day and age like this, neighbors could be a problem too.
Mm-hmm.
So you're left with maybe your religious affiliation and the support that comes through that, or some other support systems in the community. Unfortunately, you know, we live in Brevard, Florida, which has a lot of support systems, I think, built in because of the demographics of this population. Mm-hmm. But
that's fortunately,
other communities,
I think, right?
Don't. Yeah, we are fortunate.
We're fortunate,
And that's why we can all come together and do this here.
Mm-hmm.
So. But what about this? You know, many times I think that some of the barriers are pride, especially when it comes to finances, because they come from that generation where they think that Medicaid, they just don't want to have any what they call handouts. I mean, people have told that to me.
Right.
The other thing I think that I encounter is lack of awareness. Like, some of them don't know the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. So I think increasing the awareness and education is another important goal of this podcast, for them to know what the difference is and whether they're eligible or not.
Right.
And I think awareness is the biggest goal that I have when I'm putting forward, you know, my side of it as well, is to help people be aware of what options they have, what kind of support systems are in place on the legal side. Because there are quite a few, and people need to know what options they have as far as what would happen if a power of attorney isn't available to be used,
mm-hmm.
or you know, if somebody's named on the healthcare surrogate who isn't around anymore, or you know, what happens when there's a guardianship fight, or you know, so many different things happen. And that actually leads me to another point, which I get asked a lot, is what is a DNRO? Why can a lawyer not do that, for example?
Right. And that's something which comes up frequently, too, when I introduce a subject. So one of the things with geriatric care is no visit is complete unless I've asked patients if they have their affairs in order, if they've thought about DNR. And some of them will immediately say they have DNR. Sometimes they are not aware of what DNR means. Do not resuscitate. And some people, unfortunately, don't interpret it the right way. So I have to educate them and say that do not resuscitate does not mean do not treat. It does not mean abandoning. On the other hand, I always ask them, how would you feel if you passed away in your sleep? And most people say that's a blessing. That's what they are praying for. So DNR is, and I tell them, especially if they live in assisted living or in a facility where they are required to complete those forms, I asked him, how would you feel if somebody checks on you at night and finds that you have no pulse and you've passed away peacefully? And they say, well, that's what I want. Then I say, you need to have the DNR, because in the state of Florida, if you don't have these forms filled, then whoever sees you in the middle of the night has to call 911. And 911, when they come, they're going to start doing heroic measures. They're going to pump on you, jump on your heart, and connect you to a machine and shock you. And most people don't want that. So when you explain it in very clear, direct terms, most people are able to understand and make a decision. And that's something, again, we don't spend too much time on it, but it's well worth the time, because more times than not, I have caregivers come back and share stories where they didn't want their parents or their loved ones to have gone through a lot of traumatic, invasive procedures which do not yield meaningful outcomes.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. I hear when I work with clients regarding their estate planning, and one of the advanced directives that we often discuss is a living will. And the living will being different from the last will and testament, the living will is in effect while you're alive, but it determines what you want done as far as the life prolonging procedures. And according to the Florida statutes, and I can only speak to Florida law, but the statutes here require one of three conditions to be in effect, basically a life-prolonging procedures to be used if you're in a terminal condition, end-stage condition, or persistent vegetative state, and be incapacitated. And these can be very daunting words for people. I mean, what is an end-stage condition or terminal condition? And people can relate to a terminal condition, but for the living will, they have to also be incapacitated. So you can't just be walking and talking and be terminal. There's, you know, the living will is only going to go into effect and say that you want or don't want any life-prolonging procedures when you are in that stage, incapacitated, and then two physicians have to make that confirmation that you're going to then not want anything done in order for no life-prolonging procedures. Otherwise, those procedures are still going to be done.
Now, if the person does not have a living will, which happens sometimes in the hospitals, and the person is in a vegetative state, then who gets to make the decision?
Well, if there are no advance directives, if there's no healthcare surrogate in place, then a healthcare proxy is set up according to the Florida statute. And the proxy is in the first person. Under Florida statutes, there's a list, and the guardian is number one. So it's not even the spouse that can make the decision first if there's a guardian in place. And the statute is going to indicate what's going to be done. And so the healthcare proxy is going to be the person to step in and state what's going to be done. And that proxy can be in order, guardian, then spouse, and then children, and then other siblings, and on and on. But when it comes to more than one person, it can be several. And they have to do it with a majority decision. So, you know, I like to think about that like Congress. You know, you're dealing with a decision by committee, and nothing ever gets done that way. It can become very difficult to have that kind of decision making done. And so that advance directive naming the surrogate, and in this case we're talking about the living will, is then going to name an authorized decision maker to follow through on the decisions that you've made. And that will kind of be the end of the story, unless there's some contest, of course. But that is a very important document. And I like to think that the advance directives are more important than even your last will. Because for me, I care what happens to me when I'm alive. I don't care as much when I'm already dead. Mm-hmm. And so I think everybody should have at least the basics, a good power of attorney, a good healthcare surrogate, if nothing else. And you can get those for free. I mean, it's always better to go to a lawyer to have it done properly. But there are places, many hospitals provide them, many other
So tell me, what's the difference? I have patients asking me, you know, once we have this discussion, we have a Walmart right across my office, and they want to ask me if they can just walk across to Walmart because they've seen those forms. So what's the difference? Who should get it from Walmart versus who should go to legal aid versus who should go to a lawyer, and what are the pros and cons of each?
Let me give you a story of a situation that I was involved in a few years ago. There was a gentleman who, for whatever reason, didn't care for attorneys, and so he never got to go to a lawyer to get his estate planning done. Well, he was dying. He was dying of cancer, I believe, and he was already in the hospital. And his family came around his bedside, and then they decided that he should fill out a will. Well, two of his children were excluded from the will intentionally by him. However, because there was no lawyer around to help make sure that the document was done properly, they did not get it done right. And so there were certain gifts that were done that were inappropriately written through the separate written memorandum that was involved with that. And what happened, because they didn't go to an attorney, didn't spend a few $100s to get this done right, and without any legal guidance, then after he passed away, one of the disinherited children fought it. And there was a contest that involved four or five different attorneys, tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees, and a headache to the entire family. And this could have been solved much, much quicker and easier by just making a visit or two visits to an attorney and getting this done. And then that would have saved so much effort by everybody. And really, in this case, it was really only the attorneys that win because, you know, there was so much money spent in fighting this. And if it was just done right the first time, then there would not have been such a contest.
Which brings me to another thing. Sometimes I have patients who come to me where the attorney asks for a medical statement of capacity. Mm-hmm. Is the patient able to make decisions? Mm-hmm. And there are other times where patients carry a diagnosis of dementia and they've seen a neurologist and then they go change the will or, you know, change that trust, and then they come to me and they say, we just did this. I'm just curious as to what the threshold is from the attorney point of view as to whether they need a letter of capacity or not.
Well, most attorneys are not also doctors, not medical doctors. And so, as an attorney, we have only the layman's perspective when it comes to that. So if a person comes to our office and says, I want to do this, unless there is such a clear showing of incapacity, we will have the document done. Now, it depends on the situation, but it's a safer route if there's a question of capacity to do exactly what some attorneys have done and to get some letter from you indicating a capacity. Because if that letter is not done, then some family could come back and contest these very documents. And it just, again, creates so much headache for the family. Well, they may have wanted to do the right thing, but the fear on the legal side is that there was some undue influence by some family members to have these documents done. And I've been on both sides of that, and it's not a pretty thing any way you look at it. So it's much safer to have that letter of capacity that you would indicate. Now, that just because it comes from the doctor doesn't mean that the person is legally incapacitated. Right. Only a judge can provide that letter indicating that there is incapacity. The letter from you is more of a CYA situation for the attorney. And this leaves the family free to go to another attorney that may feel free to write such documents.
Now, when they come to you and they say that that the person who wants to change the will has a diagnosis of dementia, then is it mandatory to have a letter or to have the medical law?
No, it's not mandatory. Again, it's more of a safety of liability side on the attorney's side, and also for the client. You know, that way there's some determination of when these documents can be actually changed. Again, so long as a patient of yours or a client of mine were to come to me and has an idea as to their assets and has an idea as to how they want those distributed, then that may be good enough. But they really have to know the legal coinage of the term is the nature of their bounty. And so long as they can actually determine what the nature of their bounty is and how it's going to be distributed, that's all well and good. A perfect example of this is when I had a client come in with her daughter and son-in-law. And we all sit together around the table, and of course, you know, we have to find out if there's any undue influence and whatnot. So when this daughter and son-in-law leave the room, and I'm sitting there only with the mother, she says, I want to give the house to just one person, okay? And this goes on and on until we start asking other questions that are off the, I'd say, the soundtrack, okay? It's just whatever was told to the mother to say ahead of time. I want these things to go to this person. When I start asking about other questions that may not have been quoted to her to begin with, then you can see that there's nothing coming out, mm-hmm. okay? Then there's just a loop. And so it depends on the fastidiousness of the attorney, maybe, to investigate this. And some attorneys don't need to. I mean, they, as long as the document is done, that's it. It just depends as to what may happen later on. And in this case, I didn't do the documents because it was clear that while she knew that she had certain assets, she had no idea about any other assets or how things would be distributed to others. When I brought the rest of the family back in and we discussed this, while they weren't terribly happy, okay, because it wanted to go to them, the son-in-law comes, sets me aside, and he says, I think you did the right thing. And he knew that she didn't have capacity. It was just a matter of, even though he may have benefited from this, he may have needed some outside influence to say, you know, you can't do this, it's not ethical. I think there's many stories like that. And there you have it, the first podcast of Sonnet 73. Thank you for listening. Special thanks to Dr. Visa and her staff at the Health First Aging Institute, and music was provided by John Best. For more information, you can go to www.slonimlaw.com. Take care.